Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Jean Range, Senior Wealth Advisor at Ellen Becker Investment Group. Ellen Becker Investment Group is located in Pewaukee, just east of Highway 164 and Capitol Drive in the Town Bank Building. And we're also located in Whitefish Bay in the Equitable Bank Building, right across the street from my favorite store, Winkies. We're now able to serve clients in Bonita Springs, Florida. Visit our website at ellenbecker.com for more details. So before we even get started on the show, I'm going to apologize for this cold, but we didn't want to reschedule our guests. We have some great guests today talking about a very timely topic. So bear with me and we'll get started here. I'd like to start today's show by referring to our billboards. And if you've seen any of our billboards, you might have seen one of my favorite ones, which is, before we advise, we listen. And we truly do listen. All of the clients that come to us have the luxury of a free consulting appointment, which gives us an opportunity to hear about their life story. And it's through this conversation that we learn so much about them as people, as a couple, as a family. We hear their successes and challenges they faced in their jobs, investments. We hear their successes and challenges they have faced in their jobs, investments, and families. And these conversations are so important to have early on because it starts to build the roadmap for the relationship. And really, the journey with each client is very different. Sure, every client's journey may be a little bit different, but there are certain topics that are always discussed. One of these topics is estate planning. Estate planning is the foundation of every client relationship. As each family is unique, each estate planning is unique, and we plan for that uniqueness. Today, I'd like to address the uniqueness of working with families that are facing the challenges of mental health illness. Whether we are talking about substance abuse, anger management, anxiety, or depression, we can help clients plan accordingly, whether it's to plan for the expenses related to the cost of treatment or planning for the proper transition of wealth through a well-designed estate plan. So it's with this intro today that I'd like to welcome our two guests to talk about some of the challenges that clients and their families are facing around mental health. So I'd like to welcome Neil Miglowski and Megan Shefferl. They are with the Center for Behavioral Medicine, and I'd like to welcome both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Hi.
So we're going to talk a little bit about what mental health illnesses our clients are facing and the communities are facing. But before we get started, why don't you share, Neil, a little bit about your background and your credentials?
Sure. So I have a master's degree in counseling psychology from the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and currently I am the co-owner of the Center for Behavioral Medicine, where we have a specialized program for treating individuals who struggle with regulating their emotions and behavioral impulsivity. The specific type of treatment that we do is called dialectical behavior therapy, or DBT, and we are currently one of, I believe, seven programs in the country right now that are certified to do this type of treatment. And I am the team leader of our adult team. And I can introduce Megan, who facilitates our adolescent program.
Welcome, Megan. Share a little bit about your background.
Sure. Thank you. So I have my master's from Alverno College in community psychology. And I've been at CBM for just over 2 years. And I treat adults and adolescents who struggle with some of the things Neil mentioned, and we'll talk a little bit more about who we treat and what we do a little bit later.
Perfect. So when you think about what you treat, give our listeners an idea of some of the challenges your clients face on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. Just like any field or profession, we treat a specific niche of people who struggle with a really specific type of what we would call dysregulation of thoughts, behaviors, or even things like not knowing who they are. When we think about the people that we treat in this area, we really look for clients who struggle to regulate their thinking, their behaviors, and who struggle in relationships and interpersonally.
So when you think about this, part of this might be biology, right? How they're wired. When I look at, I'm one of four children in my family, we're all wired a little differently. I always tell my clients and my coworkers, I'm pretty much a type A, and I've known that forever. So my other siblings are not type A personalities, and you could see we're wired very different, but we came from the same biological parents. So share with us, you know, this whole thing around biology.
Mm-hmm. We actually think of there as being two big pieces that influence people and create what we think of as different personalities or temperaments or different struggles. And the two big pieces are both the biology, the genetics. You can kind of think of it as that genetic roll of the dice. You get what you get. There's some family influence, but even big variety within families. And the other big piece is the environment, or what we would call the social environment. What's around us, the influences between the people, the government, the cities that impact who we are and how we react to things.
So no matter how many yoga classes I go to, I can never help myself not be a type A personality. It's just how I'm wired. Is that correct?
You will hear this answer from us all the time. It depends.
I love it, because I use that answer when clients ask me questions. I always say, it depends.
It depends. We think of there as being kind of three main systems of regulation within ourselves. We think of things like how sensitive we are, how little of a cue it takes for us to have a reaction. A metaphor that we like to use at the clinic is thinking about the idea of having a motion detector. If you have a motion detector set up, is it going to take the weight of a fly to set off that motion detector, or is it going to take the weight of a person to set off that motion detector? And when we think of people, we have different emotional motion detectors. Some people, it will take a really small cue to have a big response. Some people, it'll take a lot larger cue to have a big response. And how big that response is actually based in our biology as well.
So how do you change that biology factor? Can you not? And I know you're going to say it depends, but you could use maybe some medicinal, some medicines, some scripts. Could you do some cognitive therapy to help somebody change? Is there any way of interacting with the biology part?
Yeah, there are some pieces that can be influenced, because there are times where there really is a chemical component that needs to be addressed with some kind of prescription or medical intervention. Just like there are people who have type 1 diabetes where their body is missing insulin, we have people who are missing certain brain chemicals that we can add on with prescription medications. Also, we can tie in pieces like sleep, balanced eating, exercise. We actually know that those biological components can help us regulate emotions too.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up the exercise component, because I'm reading more and more about the body's natural way of interacting with its chemistry through exercise and creating those endorphins and working that way. So that would be a great way for our society and our families to help with this challenge. Let's talk about some of the social components. When you talk about the cities that we live in, the communities, how does that impact somebody's well-being?
Well, I think one of the things that we look at that is really important is, as people are learning how to regulate their emotions, and as Megan had pointed out, it really is a combination of both the biology and then the social environment. And what we want to be able to do is to have the social environment be able to sort of match and meet the needs of what the individual's biology is. So on one hand, we can work to change the biology through medications, through mindfulness. In today's day and age, we're learning that you can actually rewire the brain through things like meditation and yoga. And we want the environment to be able to meet the emotional needs of the individual. And if you have an individual who's got a lot of more intense emotional needs, a lot of times the environment struggles to sort of meet the needs of that individual. So does the environment have the actual capacity and skills to tolerate, accept, and actually validate the other person's individual emotional experience? We want to help that environment, like we said, meet and match what the emotional needs are of the individual. you know, for a lot of people, when they don't have those capacities, the individual who's struggling to regulate their emotions, maybe hearing them, you know, you shouldn't be thinking, shouldn't be feeling, you shouldn't be doing that. And it just goes to show you're somehow weak or, you know, lazy or something of that nature. So those are the things that we're trying to sort of change, both with the individual and the environment in which they're living in.
Well, you know, if we focus in on adolescents, they have a unique environment. And I have a teenager right now, and I see it firsthand. When you think of their school, you know, back when I went to school, when you played on a competitive sport, you took the late bus home and you had dinner at the family dinner table. Now, everybody's in competitive sports. Everybody's trying to get on the select team. So it's no longer where you're eating dinner. Now we're rushing to practices. And those practices might start at 8, 9 o'clock at night, a time when people should be settling in for the evening. Let's talk about social media. I mean, cell phones. I don't know what age our daughter finally got a cell phone, but I know it's getting younger and younger. Do you see cell phones and the social aspects of that as being a huge problem in today's teenagers' lives?
Again, the answer is always going to be it depends, because we can never read into context without knowing an individual's story. We do see this idea that at times the cell phone can provide an environment where parents struggle to monitor it. And kids can get exposed to a lot of messages that their response is wrong to something. They can post something and then get response back that says that that post is wrong or bad or they shouldn't be feeling that way. And that can be problematic. I've also seen cell phones provide connections to communities where people do feel supported online or on the internet. So it's a little bit of a both and.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny. In my house, I refer to Facebook as fake book, because nobody posts their true life, their challenges. They only post the happy moments, or they make those moments appear so happy.
And I think I want to reiterate something that Megan had pointed out, which was the idea that parents really do need to be watching and monitoring their kids' contacts on social media, whether that's Facebook or Snapchat. I know as a parent, I have a 14 or a 13-year-old son who we have had some struggles, and we've had some bullying going on, and we've had just some things that were really disconcerting that we had to address. So bullying and things of that nature are happening, and the parents really do need to be on their toes.
Well, we're going to take a little break here. If you'd like to get a hold of the Center for Behavioral Medicine, they can be reached at 262-782-2820. Or you could visit their website at www.cbm-dbt.com. And again, if you'd like to talk about some financial planning and estate planning, if you're facing these challenges in your own home, please contact me, Jean Range, at 262-691-3200. Welcome back to Money Sense. I'm Jean Range, Senior Wealth Advisor at Ellen Becker Investment Group. And we are honored to have two associates from the Center of Behavioral Medicine with us today, Neil and Megan. And we're talking about the challenges families and really communities face, all the mental health illness stories that we're starting to see and hear about in the news on a daily basis. So I bring it up because when we're doing any type of financial planning or estate planning, we want to be very well aware of the dynamics within that family. Sometimes we create estate plans where we have corporate trustees for children in the event their parents were to pass away, really to help those children have support and guidance in managing their money as they're dealing with some challenges in their personal life. So this is a hot topic that I bring up with my clients who are facing this challenge, and I thought it was important that we talk about it on the radio. So we are going to continue our conversation, but now we're going to talk about why this occurs and why validating our children, our spouses, our partners' feelings are so important. And I'm going to lay this question out to either one of you. When you think of validation and people doing it properly, what are some of the consequences of not validating somebody's thoughts or feelings?
So, you know, one thing to be clear is, like, invalidation happens in our schools and our families all the time. Every time I say no to my child, to a certain extent, I'm probably invalidating a valid want or need on his part. So when he says he wants chicken McNuggets for a 13-year-old boy, that's actually understandable and valid, you know, that he would want that. But I say no because we can't live off of that all the time. So what happens, though, when that's the pervasive and the standard way of communicating in these environments? To begin with, one of the things that happens is the individual doesn't actually learn how to label their thoughts, their emotions, or their sensations in kind of a normal way. One of the things I remember growing up very early with my son is he would be angry when I had to drive him to daycare because we had to turn off Thomas the Tank Engine. And so one of the things I would make a point of saying to him would be saying, "Buddy, I understand you're disappointed that we need to turn off Thomas and we need to go." That was just a small way of trying to teach him how to label what he was actually feeling. Over time, it can kind of become a pull yourself up by the bootstraps and just do it. You know, sometimes we talk jokingly about Nike therapy, just do it. But the reality is real life isn't that easy. Real life has a lot more challenges. And if you're somebody who does have a higher level of emotionality, it's more difficult. So just do it in Nike therapy kind of overly simplifies the solution to solving life's problems. You know, and the environment doesn't actually teach the client how to tolerate when life doesn't go the way it needs to go. And it's really important that we actually are teaching, you know, our kids how to tolerate real life struggles and not always sort of swooping in and fixing them, and instead actually trying to teach them how to deal with life. And over time, they don't actually learn how to form realistic goals or expectations.
Why do you think our kids today don't have that resilience skill built into them? You know, we jokingly talk about participation awards when you're in a sport, or, you know, just being acknowledged for your effort. Mm-hmm. Why do you think, is that part of the reason kids today don't have that resilience built into them? I mean, I've used the phrase, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, push through it in my own family, because that's how I was parented. Mm-hmm. I was the fourth of four children, and we learned to just go through it. Right. So, I mean, look at today's society. What are your assumptions on why kids don't have that resilience?
Boy, that is a really complicated question. And I think it's going to depend upon understanding what the needs are of that individual. Certainly are there some kids who that is an issue for and the expectations aren't high enough? I think sometimes that can be a real issue. If you're always doing on behalf of your kid and them never learning how to do for themselves, one of the dangers that you run into is the kid learns that they can't do things for themselves and they don't learn how to do things for themselves. And at other times, you know, kids do need a higher level of validation and understanding and compassion, and they need to be taught how to do that in a very hands-on kind of way. So I think the answer is, you know, sometimes, you know, kids need to be pushed, but there are other times where kids need to be met with where they're at and be taught how to, you know, move to a higher level, if you will.
It's such a balancing act. This mm-hmm. thing called parenting is not easy.
Right. And there's lots and lots of books, but there isn't a book on every single kid.
Yeah. If my child would have come with an owner's manual, mm-hmm. you know, you wonder if I even would have read it. How many owner's manuals do you get with TVs or different electronics that you buy that you never even read?
Right. So, you know, over time, what happens with a lot of these individuals is they actually learn to invalidate themselves. So after being in an invalidating environment or being exposed to one, and again, families aren't the only invalidating environments. Schoolyards are horribly invalidating environments, and there's lots of parts of society that can be really invalidating environments. But they learn to invalidate themselves. They see themselves as incompetent or unlovable or not able. And they learn how not to trust their own reactions or perceptions because they've been told that what their reactions or perceptions are wrong, and they shouldn't be feeling that way or perceiving things that way. And so over time, they also develop this really strong sensitivity to reading other people. They may not read everybody right, but a lot of times they're really super sensitive to picking up on other people's frustrations, other people's anger, and that then gets incorporated into their sense of who they are.
So let's talk a little bit about the diagnosis and the different spectrums of experience or behavior that you see in your clients. And then we can get into some of the statistics behind this illness. And, you know, I often refer to this as the casserole-less disease, because if you are having a family member deal with cancer or heart issues, the community around you will surround you with meals and love and support. When you have a family member that is struggling with a mental health illness, you don't see that, and people often don't open up that world to their community that they're dealing with this. And it's really unfortunate because, as we've just talked about, some of this is biology, just how an individual is wired. So it's just devastating that we can see so much progress in treatments and medicine around this, but we don't see any progress as far as society accepting the challenges and working with those people. But let's get back to the topic of some of the behaviors that you see in clients that are dealing with this.
Yeah, you had mentioned diagnoses, and that is always a topic that we like to talk about and clarify a little bit, because in mental health, you find most behaviors are normal to some extent. It is normal to feel sad. It's normal to feel worried. It's normal to question your judgment. All of those things are actually fairly normal. But there is a point at which those behaviors become problematic for people and they turn into a diagnosis. And so I think a lot of the times people will throw words around like, oh, I'm feeling so anxious or I'm feeling really depressed, and really mean I'm feeling sad or I'm feeling worried. And that's normal. When feeling anxious or feeling depressed or feeling sad all the time becomes a problem that you deal with on a daily basis and it gets in the way of you functioning in your life, that's when it becomes a diagnosis, and that's when it becomes something that we want to treat.
So let's talk about some of the behaviors. So you see people with eating disorders, mm-hmm. you know. I jokingly say I'd love to have anorexia for a month just to lose weight. And, you know, obviously this is a serious conversation, and having have a friend deal with this firsthand, I no longer say that. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other behaviors that you notice in your clients?
So one of the big hallmark behaviors that we look for in the clients that we treat is people who don't want to be alive anymore, or who struggle with suicidality, or people who struggle with self-harm behaviors. I think, especially in our adolescent population, you hear about things like cutting, that self-harm behaviors can look a lot of different ways. And suicidality and self-harm are two of the things that we see a lot when people are in really extreme amounts of emotional distress.
What about substance abuse? I have read more and more articles about the self-harm. Do you see that teens and adults are struggling with substance?
Absolutely, absolutely. If we go back to, we believe the base problem being when clients struggle to tolerate distress, substances are a way to kind of check out and to not feel distress. And so it's pretty common for our clients to struggle with using all kinds of substances to serve that purpose.
So anger management, is that just a peripheral issue because of the mental illness, or is that an actual diagnosis?
Mostly peripheral. There's, to my knowledge, no hard and fast anger management diagnosis. But when we come to dysregulated anger and dysregulated behavior, that can kind of fall under the umbrella.
I think one of the things that we see with a lot of the behaviors that we're talking about, self-harming, eating disorder, substance use, anger management, the function of the behavior usually is actually very similar in that it's helping them to either regulate their emotions or it's coming out of dysregulated emotions. But one of the things I tell my clients a lot is the emotions themselves that they need to get better at feeling aren't what's going to destroy them. It's the behaviors and all the things they're doing to not feel their emotions. That's what actually destroys people, destroys families, destroys jobs.
That's a good insight into this illness. We're going to take a little break. When we get back, we're going to get into some of the statistics behind this illness. If you'd like to reach out to Neil or Megan, they can be reached at 262-782-2820. With that, let's take a break. Welcome back to Money Sense. I'm Jean Range, Senior Wealth Advisor at Allen Becker Investment Group. And today we're having a pretty serious conversation around mental health challenges that our families face, our communities face. And we're going to start this segment talking about the statistics behind this illness. And when I was preparing for today's show, I was alarmed at the numbers behind this illness. So I'm going to throw it out to either one of you. Give me an idea, suicide. We hear about it on the news. When I was preparing for today's show, I was surprised it's the 10th leading cause of death. Share with us some other stats with that.
Yeah, so we went and pulled some statistics from the CDC and from an organization called SAMHSA, which does a lot of tracking about suicides in the United States. And we know that suicide for the population at large is the 10th leading cause of death. It's actually the second leading cause of death for people ages 25 to 34. So when we think about that population as being fairly physically healthy, there are clearly some mental health concerns that might not be addressed. So think about that 10th leading cause of death. That breaks down to about 33,000 suicides a year in the U.S., or about 91 a day.
Compare that to homicides.
Yeah, so as a little bit of a marker, we think of homicide as a thing we're all scared of and that we hear about in the news a lot. Homicide is actually the 15th leading cause of death. In that 2010 numbers that I was looking at, 17,000 U.S. deaths from homicide that year, or about half of what we saw in suicides in that same year.
That is just crazy. We're going to talk a little bit about your area of expertise. And if you're listening to today's show wondering about your own family, your children, your spouse, your partner, wondering if you could benefit from going through and having a conversation with somebody to help analyze or talk with you about the potential mental health diagnosis in your own family, I want to share a little bit about your program because I find it unique and successful. So you do something called DBT therapy. And because my voice is not here, I'm going to have you explain and really identify what DBT therapy is.
So DBT, or dialectical behavior therapy, is a treatment strategy that was developed by a woman named Dr. Marsha Linehan, who's a psychologist out of the University of Washington in Seattle. And it was developed to treat really complex, often refractory problems of chronic emotional dysregulation. It was originally designed to treat a diagnosis called borderline personality disorder. When it was originally researched, treating women primarily with chronic suicidality and self-harming behaviors. And the overall arching goal of DBT is to help your client develop a life worth living. That is the overall function of what we do. It's meant to be a comprehensive program, and by that I mean it has multiple different levels or multiple different modalities of care. So to begin with, there is a DBT skills training group. And in skills training group, we're teaching our clients four different sets of skills to try to help them learn how to regulate their emotions, their moods, their behaviors, their thoughts. The first one is core mindfulness, which is primarily teaching clients how to become more aware of themselves and their environment. My quick and easy just illustration of core mindfulness is the difference between driving your car and driving your car with a cop behind you. That a lot of times when there is a cop behind you, your level of awareness in the moment goes up exponentially. Once we can get them learning how to become more aware, then they can start to catch and notice certain patterns, and they can use some of the other skills, which include emotion regulation skills, which is teaching them how to kind of get off this emotional roller coaster. And for a lot of our clients, they won't talk about it as an emotional roller as much as getting off an emotional EKG wave. So learning how to label and identify what they're feeling, and then teaching a set of strategies to regulate those feelings. We also teach distress tolerance skills, which teaches them how to survive crises and get through intense emotional moments without doing something impulsive that's going to make their situation worse, as well as learning how to accept moments that they cannot change, and learning how to just tolerate experiences that come with moments they can't change, and solving problems that they need to solve. And lastly, we teach them interpersonal effectiveness skills, which are skills both for learning how to ask for what they want, say no to what they don't want, as well as forming relationships and trying to keep them healthy and effective. So we have skills training group. That's the first thing. And then they have individual therapy as well. The individual therapist's job is to teach them what they are, or to take what they're learning in skills training group and then apply it to their individual situations. There is an ability for them to get consultation outside of their regularly scheduled sessions. So our therapists are on call, we would say 24/7 within certain limits, but they have the ability to get skills coaching in the heat of the moment, not just on a Tuesday afternoon when they have their individual session, but on a Saturday afternoon when they're dealing with, you know, whatever social situation they're dealing with. And then we also have a consultation team for the therapists, which isn't meant to be sort of a staffing and a review of cases. It's meant to help the therapist do the treatment effectively and to make sure they're doing the treatment the way it's meant to be done, making sure the therapists are keeping themselves regulated in the midst of their clients' intense emotions as well.
So I just want to add on one piece of our adolescent program that is a little bit different. Neil was referring specifically to our adult program. Within our adolescent program, we treat adolescents typically 14 to 18-ish or in that kind of high school range. We have a really strong component of wanting the families to be involved with the adolescent's treatment. And in addition to the skills that Neil talked about, we actually have a whole set of skills that we teach about the family working together called Walking the Middle Path skills, which is about helping the family decrease conflict and manage conflict skillfully. And that is a piece that we see being really impactful. We also have an outlet for the parents to reach out and receive skills coaching from therapists on our adolescent team as well.
Boy, what a comprehensive way of treating the individual as well as the family. And that I should have said more educating the individual and the family, because it appears as if you're creating the skill set or a toolkit for individuals and families to use when they're faced with that stressful moment.
And I think that is a really important point. You know, we also have, and thank you, Megan, for pointing out the adolescent component. We also have a family skills training that's for the adults, family members, for the wives and the husbands and the brothers and the sisters. And a lot of that came out of, if you're going to provide effective treatment for these individuals, you not only need to treat the individual, but you need to treat the family, and you need to treat the environment in which the individual is living in. Because so often, we once had a workshop where we had a mother of a client get up in front of 250 DBT therapists, and she basically kind of ripped us a new one. And her message to us was, you know, you guys as a therapist, you usually at best leave us out of the treatment. At worst, you blame us for the problem. And out of that, you know, came a lot of family interventions and really helping the families, because families are struggling horribly in terms of you know, managing how to help their loved one, but also managing their own emotional reactions, their own fears and sadness and the helplessness at time. And so we got to treat that piece too.
Well, when you look at the family unit, it has changed so much from the 1950s. Back in the day, oftentimes women didn't work outside the home. So now you have dual income. So you have two people working. The responsibilities of that is just the added demands of adolescence, whether it be sports or theater groups or what, the demands on our time are huge. So if you don't create the skill sets and the structure to deal with the problem, sometimes it creates more conflict.
Mm-hmm.
If any of our listeners are out there right now going, I wonder if my family could use some of this help, meaning they're looking at the challenges and the conflicts that they face day to day, what would you advise them? When is treatment necessary?
So I would say, you know, treatment's necessary to begin with whenever your gut says it's necessary. Like, one of the things we work so much with our clients is to teach them how to listen to their own sense of intuition. So to begin with, whenever your gut says it's needed, you know, whenever your loved one is expressing worry, that can obviously be an early warning sign. When the emotions or the behaviors that you all are dealing with, either the individual or as a family, are interfering with just everyday life and are causing so much distress that it's, you know, obviously getting in the way of achieving what you want to achieve in life. And lastly, you know, everyday language. Megan, do you want to say a little bit about what you were saying there in terms of everyday language versus clinical significance?
Yeah, so we think a lot about people using language like depression or anxiety, and sometimes meaning I'm just feeling sad. But when we think of depression and anxiety, we think of chronic, really like life interfering problems.
Well, when you think about it, kids who aren't able to go to school, families Absolutely. That no longer want to plan vacations, those are all little signs that they may want to seek out a conversation with somebody to see if there is a diagnosis mm-hmm. versus just dealing with sadness.
Absolutely. And we would always say it's a great idea to go in and talk to someone. You're not committing to anything at that point, but getting a professional to step in and kind of help you assess the situation can be helpful.
Right. It affirms that you either could benefit from continued conversations or know what you're dealing with is just the normal issues with teens.
Absolutely.
We're going to take a short break. Again, if you want to reach out to Neil or Megan, they can be reached at 262-782-2820. With that, let's take a break.
News Talk 1130, WISN Milwaukee.
Welcome back to Money Sense. I'm Jean Range, Senior Wealth Advisor at Allen Becker Investment Group. We're located in Pewaukee, Whitefish Bay, and we're now able to serve clients in Bonita Springs, Florida. We've had a great conversation with Neil and Megan, and they are part of the Center for Behavioral Medicine located in Brookfield. And we've had a pretty good conversation around mental health challenges that many of our families face today. And we just ended a segment where they shared how comprehensive this whole program called DBT therapy is, which I find interesting because it's very different than going to a counselor once a week, every Tuesday at 5 o'clock or whatever time it may be. They do counseling almost 24 hours, 7 days a week. And again, not only do you touch the individual with the diagnosis, you're also working with the family and with the psychiatrists and with the communities and schools to really help support this individual. So let's expand a little bit on that support that goes to your clients and the individuals that reach out to your group.
Well, I think with that, one of the things I often say, my staff is the hardest working staff in rock and roll. We do a lot of support work, a lot of skills coaching outside of just that regular, you know, 1 hour a week therapy session. Plus the skills training group actually is 2.5 hours a week. But in between that, we're doing a lot of phone coaching in between sessions, a lot of helping how to deal with just the stresses in life, because we want to teach them how to apply the skills when the situation is actually going on. That's the best time to teach skills, is to strike while the iron is hot. And the phone calls and the telephone consultation, it's not just psychotherapy. They're not getting hour-long psychotherapy sessions over the phone for us. It's meant to be a 10-minute, you know, skills coaching session. And clients are really great at taking them and putting the skills to work immediately. And this is one of the things that really, I think, leads to a lot of success in DBT, is they've got that extra help and support outside of their regularly scheduled sessions.
So you really see this, and you're touching the families in such a positive way. Mm-hmm. So you're educating them, you're training them to work with their family members. How do you keep your staff motivated? I mean, I go to work, and sure, we all have challenging moments, but when you all go to work, every person you meet, it's a challenging situation. How do you stay positive and motivated?
For me, I always say it's really easy to be passionate about something that saves people's lives. And when I first got into this, the people that we were trying to help who were struggling with these problems, there wasn't a lot of really great treatment at all. And they just struggled, and they would be struggling with suicidality and going in and out of hospitals. And when all of a sudden I found dialectical behavior therapy and it worked, it's really easy for me to be passionate about that. I think the other piece for me, and I'm going to let Megan maybe answer this one, is going back to how do we keep ourselves motivated. I think the team that I work with and just the culture that DBT really fosters, I think, is a huge part as well.
I would get on board with that too. The environment of our office is unlike anything I've experienced before, and I think it comes out of the fact that we try really hard to walk the walk. We use the skills that we teach on a daily basis to manage our own emotions and distress when working with really challenging clients, and that allows us to celebrate small successes in a really cool way. And I know that my team's going to be there to support me no matter what. And if I can tolerate my reaction to things, it makes me a more effective therapist.
So in going through your notes, I note that you are one of 7 certified DBT therapy programs in the country. So you gave a good analogy where I'm a certified financial planner. You can go to anybody for advice, but would you want to go to anybody or a certified financial planner? Share with us why that's so important in your world.
Because we have the certification that we have, it means that there are certain standards that we're held to in doing all of the pieces of comprehensive therapy. There's a lot of DBT-informed therapy out there, meaning that people will use pieces and parts of the program as it was developed to inform kind of a standard therapy practice. But comprehensive and certified DBT means that we pull in all of those components, especially the components that happen outside of your standard therapy session.
I think one of the things to just highlight is a lot of times one of the great struggles for individuals and families is finding good treatment. And one of the things that we want to make sure, or one of the things that we think is so important, is making sure that when you're looking for a DBT program, you're actually buying what you're paying for. And you're not buying a watered down, diluted version that may not provide you, the family, or their loved one all the treatment that they need. You wouldn't provide, or you wouldn't seek out diluted chemotherapy if you had cancer. You'd want the whole treatment. And so the certification basically indicates that we provide the whole treatment as it was researched to be effective.
So let's talk about a success story. And I know you have many, but we're going to focus on the Mental Health Center of Greater Manchester, New Hampshire. And I found these statistics amazing. Share with our listeners what some of these numbers are.
So this was a study that was done around 1999. It won the gold standard by the American Psychiatric Association for a research study. This involved the pre-year versus post-year of DBT with a group of 14 clients in a community mental health center. What they found was by providing DBT to these 14 clients, they cut their treatment cost by more than half, from $645,000 for 14 clients down to $273,000. They showed a 77% decrease in hospital bed days, from 479 days in the hospital to 85 days. Overall, there was an 80% decrease in face-to-face contact with emergency services, from 61 contacts down to 12. So this is a treatment that really saves lives. It saves money. It provides treatment that causes depression to improve, anxiety to improve. It teaches people how to tolerate distress so their impulsive behaviors go down. And this is what improves quality of life.
Well, excuse me. I hope our listeners have really heard and understand the benefits of a comprehensive, well-rounded treatment program. And again, if you want to reach out to the Center for Behavioral Medicine, please contact 262-782-2820. With that, as always, we hope we've made a difference in your personal and financial well-being. Remember, before we plan, before we advise, before we invest, we always listen. Be well and have a great day.